that helps them hate unions, and again, believe that their economic problems are due to the federal government or immigrants or refugees. So they have drunk the Kool-Aid, and they haven't quite hired out to the landowners directly yet, but that's the next step.
I've had an opportunity to really talk about this, but in the last...
And we're almost out of time.
Okay. Out of time. Maybe you could say just real quickly what you experienced with the Paiute tribe who claims the land,
yes,
and is working with the federal government, yes, in preservation of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge.
Well, the Paiute were very strong in reminding everybody that they have a existing treaty with the United States government, and that is their land. And they have worked out some arrangements with BLM to protect their sites and allow access. But they're really strong. They were they were checking out this march. They were not buying it when I saw it. They were following it. They did not look amused. Mm-hmm. And they've made great statements. And we are sitting down with coffee for coffee with them very, mm-hmm, soon. So
we want to thank Mike Edera from the Rural Organizing Project for getting us update about militias in Oregon, what's going on in Harney County, and prior to that, Josephine. So for Jamie Partridge, myself, John Walsh, for Mike, and for Mike, our engineer, thank you, Mike.
Thanks.
Thank you
lot.
All for listening, and we'll tune in next week, please.
Thanks.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime, and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. My guest tonight is Marie Levin from Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity Coalition and California Families Against Solitary Confinement. Marie Levin's brother, Zatawa Nantambu Jamaha, was one of the main representatives of the Pelican Bay prison strikes to protest the cruel, inhumane, and torturous conditions in California's security housing units, or SHUs. In 2012, Zatawa Jamaha, along with other prisoners in the Pelican Bay prison SHU, filed a class action against California's governor. In September 2015, a settlement in this case was reached that transformed California's use of solitary confinement. Marie Levin, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, Marie, before you give us an update on what's happened since the settlement, remind our listeners what the conditions are like in the California SHUs, these security housing units.
Well, the security housing unit is a concrete windowless cell that's less than 8 by 12, and it only contains a sink, a toilet, and so there's no fresh air coming in. Inside the cell, you know, your food is given to you through a slot. There's lack of touching, so the only touch that you get is when the guards are putting the handcuffs on when you're entering and exiting the cell. The yard is another concrete slab that's maybe 22 feet long, 20 feet high. It's not a big place. It's just what they call a dog run. And even in there, there's no sunlight. The top, and I think they changed it, but the top was just completely covered with plexiglass. Part of it was plexiglass that you couldn't see out of. So they couldn't see a bird flying. They couldn't see leaves blowing.
And Marie, they were in these cells for up to 24 hours each day.
23 hours a day. So basically they're only allowed to go to the yard for an hour a day. So, and sometimes they would lock them up for 24 hours. Yes, they would.
And Marie, your brother, Satawa Jamaha, was in one of these SHU cells for how long?
He was in a SHU cell for 31 and a half years.
31 and a half years. And why was he being held in these conditions?
Originally, it was because of the prison guards labeling him as a gang member. And when they label you as a gang member, they throw away the key, you know, back then. And that was a part of there. So there's four different ways to get to become, to get into the SHU. One was you would read a George Jackson book, which my brother did. He celebrated Black August, and anything that has George Jackson's name on it that goes into prison, whether it be through a letter, through a book, they label you as a gang member. Now, it's odd enough that if this book is circulating in the prison, why would you keep it there if that's, you know, if that's what you say can cause a person to get become labeled as a gang member. Anyway, that was one. The other one is that they do Aztec art. People that draw, they have cultural Aztec art tattoos on their body, or you acknowledge somebody in passing. Those are the four things, the four main things that they used to label a person as a gang member. And like I said before, once they label you as a gang member, they threw away the key. You either snitch or died. So that's what the guys, you know, would say. The only way I'm getting out of this shoe is if I snitch or die, and I'm not snitching, so I guess I'm going to die, you know.
So a prisoner actually did not have to violate a prison rule to get thrown in one of these cells. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And this could be indefinite, as in the case of your brother, over 30 years.
Yes, yes.
How often did you visit your brother in the SHU?
Well, for many years, I didn't visit my brother. My mother and my sister and one of my aunts would go visit him once a year. And then in 2011, when they decided that they would go on a hunger strike, that's when I started visiting again. You know, for me, it was out of sight, out of mind. And I visited my brother through my mother and my sister and my aunt. And it was painful for me, and that was really one of the reasons why I didn't visit on a regular basis. When 2011 came, I would go visit my brother. I wasn't approved then. I didn't get approved until 2012. So I started visiting my brother every other month.
So, Marie, how did you learn that your brother and others were planning these strikes in the prison?
I learned this through a letter that my brother sent me in the mail stating that he was going to go on a hunger strike and he was willing to die. And he wanted to change the conditions inside. He didn't want anyone to come after him and have to go through what he has gone through all these years. But when I checked the website he gave to me, there was nothing on there. And so one of the lawyers that visited them contacted me and let me know that he was going to go on a hunger strike and let me listen to a tape that had his voice on it stating that he loved me, he loved the family, and he was going to go on a hunger strike. And if he died, he died, but he wanted us to know that he loved us. So that was my first encounter about my brother going on the hunger strike. And when I listened to it, they were having a rally on July 1st of 2011, and that's when the guys were going to go on the hunger strike. And so I went to a rally that they had, and that's when I learned about the conditions of how bad it was in the SHU security housing unit.
And what was your reaction when you learned that your brother was planning a hunger strike?
Well, my reaction was, well, my mother can't go visit him and my sister can't go visit him anymore, so I'm going to have to step up to the plate. So when I learned about him wanting to go on this hunger strike, I just felt that I needed to support him. You know, I just needed to support him because the rest of my family that was doing it, was not going to be able to do it. My mother had had a stroke in 2010 that left her incapable of going even to visit him anymore. And my sister died in 2010 of that same year.
What was your reaction, though? What did you feel was going to come of a hunger strike? Were you hopeful? Were you feeling that it was a waste of time? What was your reaction?
Well, yes, I absolutely was hopeful that, you know, they would get the demands, especially these guys are going on a hunger strike, and that they would get the five core demands that they had answered. You know, their request would be made known, but and the CDC would make some changes, but that didn't happen. You know, but yes, I was hopeful. I was not afraid. I felt like, you know, to go on a hunger strike is something that's serious, but I've gone on a number of fasts, which is the same thing as like a hunger strike, but I'm doing a spiritual fast. So I know that you can still live and during a fast. You know, you're not going to die just because you don't eat,
mm-hmm.
you know. So I knew that he could do it, you know. I knew that he could, and I trusted that, you know, that at some point CDC was going to give in or, you know, answer their five core demands.
So you trusted that the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation was going to meet their core demands?
Yeah, I thought this was like a big thing, you know, so the guys going on a hunger strike. At that time, I didn't know that they had been on hunger strikes before, but never to this magnitude. So, yeah, I was hopeful that something was going to, you know, change.
Did you know what the core demands were at that point and how they're just very simple demands and group punishment and stopped the debriefing policy where prisoners are labeled as snitches and provide adequate and nutritious food? Very, very minimal demands.
Right. No, I did not originally know that. I didn't know that originally what their demands were. I learned that as time went on. But on that initial occasion, you know, I just was in support of my brother, and I was, you know, I was a little teary because I hadn't seen him, and for him to say that he was willing to die and all of this stuff, you know, it was serious. And when I went to that rally, and there was a gentleman there who is a part of LSPC, Dorsey Nunn, who described to me what the shoe was like, and I did not know him. I was standing next to him, and he was telling me what the shoe was like and what the dog run was like, and I literally just broke down in tears. Like, I just broke down, and I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. I just broke down and cried like a baby. That's all I could describe it, you know. And after I finally finished crying, because I know I had to cry at least 5-10 minutes because I was crying profusely, and when I finally finished crying, he said to me, he said, "When was the last time you seen your brother?" I said, "It's been at least over 15 years. And he said, "Well, you get your papers in order. You go and, you know, fill out your papers. And once you get that done, you call and let me know, and I'll make sure you get there. I will make sure that you get there."
And at that time, during the 2011 hunger strike, when thousands of prisoners across California joined in solidarity with the hunger strikers' demands, when you learned of the magnitude of this whole protest, what were your thoughts?
Oh, to definitely go out in every rally that they had that I could go to, I was trying to go to. And they had the Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity Coalition formed after that meeting in San Francisco, that rally. And I went to find out, to learn more about what was going on and what was happening. So I started getting involved.
So let's fast forward to the settlement. So in 2012, a group, including your brother, of prisoners in the California Pelican Bay Shoes filed a civil action against the governor of California, and again, demanding to stop the torture of solitary confinement. And just last year, September 2015, a settlement was reached. Talk about the settlement.
Well, the settlement was, and the most part that I take away from the settlement was that the fact that my brother was going to get the opportunity to get out of solitary confinement, and he would have a contact visit. And that was something for me that was very major, because at that time it was maybe 28 or 29 years in 2012. It was those many years that I hadn't, at that point, gotten to give my brother a hug, you know, shake his hand, nothing. No, there was no contact. So from in 2015, when they settled out of court, it was like a major, major breakthrough. And at this point, it's 31 plus years. You know, the months are ticking away. So,
Marie, as a family member, your brother was in solitary confinement, no contact for over 30 years. You finally start going to visit him. And now, after this settlement, he is released from the SHU. He is placed back in general population with full visiting rights. Describe that first visit with your brother after 30 years. Finally, a contact visit. You get to hug him, hold him, kiss him. Describe that for us.
When my brother came out, because we were in the visiting room, he came out, and he didn't see me. He walked right by me. And then when he turned around, I was already out of my seat, and I ran to him, speedily walked, you know, to my brother, which was maybe about 8 feet away from me, and I walked quickly to my brother and gave him a great big hug. And we held for a while, and he said, "Hey, sis," you know, and we went and sat down in the assigned seat, and then we began our visit. But it was leading up to that, the drive going down there, I was crying, you know, I didn't know how I would feel when I, you know, actually get a chance to have a contact visit with him, and just reminiscing on the years that he's been deprived this. We, as a family, have been deprived this. And so that was, like, really major. You know, I think I felt more, I had so much anticipation in walking in, and actually on my my first visit, it was like, you know, we wanted to feed him. He didn't want to eat anything. So it was like he just wanted to just sit there with us and just talk, you know, and that was a good thing. So it was a real major. And I was just so happy and so proud that, you know, all this struggle that they did inside of starving themselves, and the struggle and the fight that we were doing on the outside on their behalf, going to Sacramento and going before legislators and going on radio programs and all these different things. It's just, you know, it was good. It was good. It was just good. So that was one of the most significant things to me that came out of the lawsuit. There were other things, but that was the most significant one.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James, and I'm speaking with Marie Levin, the sister of one of the main prisoner representatives who helped bring an end to indefinite solitary confinement in California prisons. I'd also like to announce that just this month, here in Oregon, the Oregon Department of Corrections agreed to reduce isolation and improve the care of seriously mentally ill adults in custody in the Behavioral Health Unit at the Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem. This comes following an investigation by Disability Rights Oregon, and more information can be found on their website at dro.org. Marie Levin, when will he release from prison?
I don't know. My brother had a sentence of 25 years to life. He went to prison for a crime that he did not commit. The person that did commit the crime admitted to it on the witness stand and got out after 5 years. So, like I said, once they label you as a gang member, then they have this jacket on you, you know. So we have to I really want to work toward getting my brother out of there. They, I believe, passed a bill called SB 261, and that states people that were under, I believe, 24 years old, that they will, you know, they can be paroled out. My brother was 22 when he was locked up. So he fits in that category, which is, you know, of course, real, very, very, very hopeful for us.
Yes.
You know.
Yes. So are all of the plaintiffs of this civil suit that was settled in September 2015, are all of the plaintiffs in general population now?
No, they're not.
And why not?
Because, unfortunately, they want to pin on them something they say, two of them, they want to pin on them stating that they had some gang activity, and so they're doing an investigation. And then another one of them, they said that people were a threat to him, and they wanted to keep him locked up.
Mm. Are they emptying the shoes?
They're still putting people in the shoes.
For violation of prison rules or just for the same reasons that they are gang-affiliated? What are the reasons they're being put in the shoe?
Several people were already validated as gang members. So those group of people that they had already validated before the settlement, they still are shipping them to the SHU.
I understand there is a limit now. They cannot be placed in there indefinitely. Is that correct?
That is correct. That is correct.
So they do have an opportunity of getting out.
They do have the opportunity of getting out. And it was all the people who were 10 years or above are being released out of the SHU. And the people that's going into SHU is because they, you know, they were on this list or whatever. So they're going into the SHU. But I believe that those... these guys have to have their review, and I think it's 60 day. It's a 60-day review that they have to give them. You know, once they enter into the SHU, they have to give them a 60-day review, and that's something that they didn't enforce all these years. They didn't enforce this rule when you're in the SHU. You're supposed to have a 60-day review. But now they're starting to do that. And as far as those people who, you know, were 10 years and above, like I said, they are being released to general population.
Marie Levin, when this all started, did you ever think that this would draw worldwide attention?
No, I did not.
Why is it important to raise this awareness?
It's important to raise the awareness because it's not just happening in California. It's happening everywhere, you know, in all the states and even the private prisons. There, I'm told that their conditions are worse than these guys because it's a private prison and they don't treat them right. And it's important that the world knows about it, you know, because that's when action is taken. When nobody knew about it, it just continued for years and years and years. And that was why the guys were prompted to do a hunger strike to get attention. And they wanted it to be nationally. They wanted it to be internationally. They wanted it to get out there so people can know what is truly happening in America.
How did your brother, Satawa Nantambu Jamaha, keep his sanity for 30 years in those conditions in the California prison?
My brother kept his sanity by reading one book five times, you know, keeping up with current events because he had a TV inside. My brother actually had a cellmate, and for him, I believe that he probably realized a long time ago that, you know, you probably would go stir crazy, but his motive for having a cellmate was to teach the cellmate. You know, he's a teacher. He teaches you about the culture and have you your mind stirred about the current affairs and even the conditions in prison, making the people aware of the conditions inside. So
how is he doing right now? And the other prisoners, does the fight continue?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. My brother has put together what he calls a blueprint, and this blueprint is how he feels that the prison should be ran. In each prison, what he is suggesting that the prisoners form a human rights committee, or, four of them, so there would be a white guy, a black guy, Northern Mexican and the Southern Mexican, just like they had for the, they were the four main reps, those different nationalities. And they formed this group, this human rights movement group in each prison. And then they would be like a council and helping these guys to see, you know, what they put together in 2012, the agreement to end hostilities. This is something that they put together in 2012, and they want to continue to promote it. They actually sent a copy to the warden, to the governor, to everybody at CDC, the heads of the CDC, and they wanted to have it distributed to the prisons, to the detention centers, to the jails, to on the streets. But they wouldn't promote it, you know, and it was something that unfortunately, the prison system would not support, because they like to keep the violence up against the prisoners.
Marie Levin, is there anything else that you wanted to add?
Yes, I'd like to add that every 23rd of the month, we have been out on the streets doing rallies in support of the guys and trying to continue the fight for to end solitary confinement, because at the present moment there are prisoners who are in solitary confinement and they're sleep deprivation and they're torturing them still, you know, and it's awful that these guys have to literally endure not sleeping. And the sad part about it is we on the outside, they give people who have sleep apnea a mask to get the proper rest, because their body, you know, wakes up too often, you know, and their sleep is broken. They don't get a full night's sleep. Well, here, guys, and they're deliberately torturing them by waking them up every 30 minutes. Every 20 to 30 minutes.
And what is the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation or the prison, what is their reason for doing that, this sleep deprivation?
They have said that their reason for doing it is there was a lawsuit that was some years ago, I believe 10 years ago, a Coleman lawsuit where the prisoners are in there and they're committing suicide in solitary confinement. And so supposedly this was put in place back then to prevent them from committing suicide. And it's like a suicide watch in a way, you know, they call it wellness checks. So they're walking up the stairs making noise. They're opening the sliding the doors making noise. Their keys are jingling. They're when they pass by, they have to use a tool or instrument where they hit on the door to make sure that it beeps. That makes a noise, and the beeping makes a noise. And for some prisoners, if, you know, say their head is turned away from the door, they shine the light on them, or their head is covered. They shine the light to make sure that they're awake. So all of this stuff, every 30 minutes, these guys are being tortured doing this too. So they, 24 hours a day, they don't get any sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So that's torture.
Yeah. Marie, how can people help? How can people get involved?
Well, we have a number of things that people could do. And one of the ways is going on the website, prisonerhungerstrikesolidarity.wordpress.com. If people wanted to actually call, there's a number, 510-426-5322. We also have an email that's prisonerhungerstrikesolidarity@gmail.com.
Marie Levin, I want to thank you so much for being my guest and updating us about the settlement that has indeed transformed California's use of solitary confinement. And thanks to your brother and other prisoners who have endured this and yet found the strength to strike and do all this work to file a civil action on behalf of all prisoners. So thank you so much, and all the best to you and your family.
We just want to get the word out that we got to just end solitary confinement. So thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to our engineers, Danielle and Mike. Good night.
On Monday, February 15th at 6:30 p.m., Prison Pipeline will air a Valentine's Day special to bring to light the fact that, because of incarceration, many people are separated from their friends, family, and lovers on Valentine's Day. We will be reading your short messages to your friends and loved ones on air. So whether you are behind bars and reaching out, or are out and reaching in, we welcome you to mail or email us your Valentine's messages. Our email address is kboppc@gmail.com, and our address is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Address your messages to Prison Pipeline Collective. Then tune in on February 15th at 6:30 p.m. to hear your messages read on air.
Hi, this is John Chuck, host of Religion for Life. I'm beginning a series called Islam 101, Meet Your Muslim Neighbor. I'll be talking with local Muslims in the Portland area, as well as Quranic scholars. This week, I speak with Ali Hadroj of the Islamic Center of Portland. Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
Eyes for Allah, nothing but Allah. Ba is the beginning of Bismillah. Ta is for taqwa, the wearing of Allah.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Real Music Film Festival running through February 8th. Tuesday, February 2nd will be They Will Have to Kill Us.